Today's Music Industry Forum podcast is brought to you by Music Row Search. Music Row Search is the industry's only full-service executive search firm which focuses exclusively on placements within the music industry. On the web at www.musicrowsearch.com.
Good morning. Welcome to the Music Industry Forum interview. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Good. I can't thank you enough for being here. Folks, let me introduce to you our special guest today. His name is John Simpson, the Executive Director of Sound Exchange based in Washington, D.C. I'm going to allow John to tell you everything about what Sound Exchange does and why they are so relevant today and in becoming increasingly more relevant every single day. Without any further ado, John, I'd like you to start off talking to us about what puts you in the position that you currently occupy. In other words, give us the snapshot of your music career and how you landed where you are.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. I've probably been in the business long time, maybe too long a time, but I started out in the late 60s playing in bands in high school and got signed to a record deal when I was 20. And, you know, I grew up with a great bunch of musicians. Tommy Mandel, who played keyboards with me, grew up in a neighboring town, and we played together, you know, when we were young. And then Tommy went on to play with Dire Straits and Bryan Adams. The guitar player who played in my high school band ended up in a group called Stories that had a big number one hit. And so, I started playing in junior high school in the 60s and had my record deal, got so successful that I went to law school. And, I started working with performers as an entertainment lawyer in the early 1980s and transitioned into managing artists. I was very fortunate to manage some really wonderful artists, some of them became, quite successful. And I got to work on some interesting projects. And then I think having worked, in this business, I was also very political, always had been. When I was first asked about getting involved in the performance rights campaign in 1994, 1995, trying to get the very first performance rights bill passed in U.S. history, I got a number of other managers involved and a number of other artists. I was managing artists at the time, and Mary Chapin Carpenter, who was one of my clients, got involved in the campaign. And I reached out to Sheryl Crow's manager, who got involved, and Billy Joel's manager, who got involved. And, we just helped push the ball a little bit, and there were lots and lots of people from the unions, from record companies, all trying to accomplish this. And we were able to get a bill passed in 1995. Little did I ever think that 5 years later I would actually go to work for the organization. It's been a fascinating 8 years that I've now been at Sound Exchange. I was the first employee in the year 2000, and I was hired by the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA. It was the major labels who had the money to invest in creating a collecting society before there was a revenue stream, frankly. So it's similar to the way that the National Music Publishers Association had built Harry Fox back in the 20s. When you have a compulsory license, it makes sense to build a collective organization to administer those rights. I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of myself. But in any event, it's I think those are the kinds of experiences that helped shape, the way I approach the business and why I ultimately ended up here.
John, tell us specifically what gave birth to Sound Exchange and what it does to protect the rights of copyright holders.
Sure. As I mentioned, in 1995, I became part of a coalition that was trying to secure the first performance right in United States history for recording artists and copyright owners of sound recordings, typically a record label, but it could be the record producer, could be the artists themselves if they own their own masters, which is, certainly an increasing category. Both artists who choose to fund themselves and own their own stuff, or maybe they license, but they still continue to own. And artists who, after a long career, have been able to get reversion of their recordings where they now have the rights back. But back in 1995, just to give you an idea, in the 1930s, the British got a performance right, British performers, which meant that when British performers' work is used on radio, on television, in clubs, doctor's offices, wherever, the recording artist on that recording is receiving a fee. People in this country always understand ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. They've been around a long time, ASCAP since 1914, BMI 1940, CSAC 1933, I believe it was the 1930s. And those three organizations have been there to protect songwriters when their songs are publicly performed. We've never had that right, you know, on the recording side, and so people, it's a little more foreign in the United States. That's not the case in Europe. Every country in Europe, in Western Europe certainly, has a performance right where the recording artist gets paid when their songs are being used publicly. You know, Canada's a newcomer. They got their rights about 10 years ago, in 1998. But we're really alone in the modern world right now, the United States, in not having a full performance right where radio, TV, and other venues that use recorded music aren't paying. They pay the songwriter, but they don't pay the performer. They pay the music publisher, but they don't pay the record company or whoever owns the masters. So we decided we had to change that. There'd been attempts, you know, over time, and I can certainly run you through a history at some point if you'd like. But, you know, in 1995, we were able to get a digital performance right passed. And essentially, Congress was saying, In new digital technologies, we're not going to repeat the mistakes of the past where we didn't provide for this. But going forward, recording artists and those who own the copyrights in the sound recordings will have a performance right when things are digitally streamed, whether that's cable, satellite, or internet. So satellite radio now, you know, has a performance royalty they have to pay to the performer as well as the songwriter. Internet radio has to pay a royalty to the recording artist as well as to the songwriter. And the same is true for those music channels you get over your cable system or DirecTV, dishNET, those blue screen music channels. You know, they usually put up a little factoid about the band you're listening to or the artist you're listening to. Mm-hmm. But it's not a video channel. It doesn't show videos. It really just plays music. So those are we now have a right to collect from those services. Even the broadcasters, the over-the-air broadcasters, you know, to AM/FM radio, when they stream from a website, they have to pay. So it's kind of interesting now when they're streaming they're sending their broadcast over the air to their listeners, they don't pay SoundExchange. But when they're streaming from a website, they do pay. And one of the real problems here is that when they transition to HD, which a lot of them are trying to do right now, HD radio, even though it's digital and looks very much like a digital, it is a digital stream, but it looks very much like a satellite radio or an internet radio type of stream, they still won't have to pay for those HD signals because when the 1995 law was passed, they were their bargain was, we get grandfathered, we don't have to pay. Even though these new services, who will compete with us, will have to pay.
Tell us, John, about some recent developments in your world that create, shall we say, more equality and equity for these copyright owners.
Well, you know, we're continuing to fight for full rights for recording artists and copyright owners. And there's a campaign right now to get AM/FM radio stations to pay. We've tried to craft it very carefully so that small mom-and-pop radio stations and small markets are protected. When this legislation was introduced this past year, there was a provision that said, if you're a non-commercial station, you pay a flat fee of $1,000 for all the music you stream during the year. If you're a commercial station, but your revenues are under $1,250,000 a year, you pay $5,000 as a flat fee, $400 a month, roughly, for all the music that you play. You know, I think the key to understand is that over-the-air radio earns $16 billion a year playing sound recordings. People don't tune in to listen to the commercials. People tune in to hear the music. And the people whose music they use ought to be compensated. The songwriter's compensated. Why isn't the recording artist? you know, you go back into the 50s and Sinatra was leading a campaign for this, saying, hey, people are playing my songs on the radio, not because of who wrote them, but because I'm singing them. And, is you know, he had absolute respect for the songwriters. He loved great songwriters. He also loved great musicians. He wanted to make sure his orchestra, his backing session players were compensated for these recordings when people were using them and generating profits. 60% of what gets played on commercial radio is over 2 years old. Things that are over 2 years old, you know, you're not promoting a new album. You're not promoting a tour in particular. You're playing something because it suits your purposes, because you know that people will listen to that song so that they'll stay tuned to listen to the advertising. That's how over-the-air radio makes their money. They need you to keep tuning in. I think good analogy. Radio stations play Major League Baseball. And it's clear that by playing baseball games on the airwaves, they promote the team. They promote sales of the merchandise. They promote the players and making them bigger stars. You know, people might go out to the ballpark and buy tickets. But do you think Major League Baseball gives radio those games for free? No, they pay a fee. Obviously, whatever benefit they may provide is factored into the price. And the same should happen here. There ought to be a negotiation between radio stations and content owners over what's a fair price, factoring in how substitutional is it. You know, how much does this substitute for people buying music, and how much does it promote people buying music? You know, we had a hearing on in the Judiciary Committee, and Sam Moore of Sam and Dave, you know, Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, some great, you know, I Thank You, some great old songs from the late 60s. You know, testified. The NAB said, oh, we help promote your tours. And Sam said, look, I'm in my 70s now. I'd rather be home with my grandkids than out touring. But because I don't get paid a performance fee every time you use my songs on the radio, unlike the songwriters who got paid very well for those songs, because I don't have that revenue stream, I do have to keep out there touring in my 70s. So, you know, it's a really unfair situation where these folks' music is being used all the time to generate profits for radio, and they're not sharing in it. No one's promoting the sale of Hold On, I'm Coming or Soul Man, you know, playing that song today. It's a big loss internationally as well, because, you know, the United States creates the repertoire for the world. In many countries, U.S. repertoire makes up 30 to 50% of what gets played. So in a lot of, and in all those countries, there's a performance right. They collect money for the recording artists and the labels. But because our country doesn't have a right, because we don't recognize that right, when they collect the money in France, when they collect the money in the UK, other countries in Europe and Asia, they keep the money. They do not send it back here to U.S. performers. They say, well, you don't collect money and protect our performers in the United States, so it wouldn't, you know, so we're not going to protect your performers in our country. There was a convention treaty signed in 1961 called the Rome Convention, the treaty about the protection of recording artists and intellectual property. And because we didn't sign it, the United States didn't sign it, we don't have reciprocity with these countries that did. And I would guess that we're losing about $100 million a year. It's hard to completely figure out the number, because in some countries, they're not allowed to collect for the share of U.S. repertoire being played. In other countries, they do collect for it. They just don't pay it to us.
I'm glad to hear you describe what Sound Exchange is trying to do to maybe right that wrong. So,
well, we're working very hard as part of a coalition. There's 13 organizations that have joined together. Sound Exchange is one of them. You know, and it's organizations that represent artists, like the Recording Artists Coalition, the Recording Academy, which actually represents lots and lots of people, and, you know, they're a big tent. They have songwriters, they have recording artists, engineers, producers, they have people who work at labels. You've got the unions, the AFM, AFTRA. You have the Society of Singers, the Vocal Group Hall of Fame, which typically look after legacy artists. You have the RAAA representing the big labels, and you have A2IM, which represents the independent labels, and a number of other groups that have all banded together in support of this idea. We had legislation introduced this year. We had three hearings over the last year and a half, and it's been very significant that we've had champions who are the chair people of the Judiciary Committee, both in the Senate and in the House, the first time we've ever had the chairman, chairwoman of those committees as our sponsors, as our champions. And, you know, legislation will come up again in the new Congress after the election. And we are very, you know, confident that we are going to make even more progress this year. And hopefully we'll get the law passed in 2009. If it takes us till 2010, we'll be there. 2011, we know that this is right. It's what's fair. You create something, you should have the right to decide who gets to use it and on what terms.
I totally hear you. What is their basis for hanging on to the old laws then? I mean, it makes so much sense how you describe that.
Well, you know, look, I think you have to recognize they built a business model on free music, and they were strong enough in the 20s and in the 30s. And you know, it's interesting because in the 20s, it really wasn't free music in the sense that frequently in the 1920s, recording artists were getting paid to play on the radio. They would have Paul Whiteman or Fred Waring or any of the really popular big bands would be sponsored by Maytag or RCA or whoever it might be to play, you know, an hour on Sunday night. And the public loved that, these live performances. But radio in the 1930s realized, well, we can just play the records. We don't need to pay these bands to come in anymore. And they stopped paying the groups, and the groups were really very unhappy about it. In fact, Paul Whiteman in the 1930s went to his record company and had them put on his label, not authorized for radio play. You know, you always hear radio say, well, you know, would you rather we not play your stuff than pay you? Paul Whiteman said, yeah, don't play me. I'd rather you not play me. I'd rather get paid. And there's any number of other artists who would tell you the same thing. I would rather you pay me than play me. So I think it's very clear that, you know, people who've had something for free don't want to have to pay for it. And that's what's held us up. Now, I think it's short-sighted of broadcasters because ultimately everybody's moving online. When WiMAX is here and WiMAX is in the car and there's a two-way communication available where you can make what's being played to you smarter and more in tune with what you want to hear, I think that's going to be the preferred technology. And therefore, everyone's going to be moving that way. We may be 10 years from that. We may be 15 years from that. But rather than embrace that, you know, the broadcasters, rather than sit down with us to try to negotiate something to give them a transition period, you know, just to basically said, the head of the NAB, David Rear, basically said at a panel, I'd rather slit my throat than negotiate. So they've made their position pretty clear, even though some of their own champions in Congress in the last session were urging them to sit down at the table with us and try to work some things out.
Look into your crystal ball for a minute, if you can, and give us some predictions about what you see happening 5-10 years down the road, both with Sound Exchange and its growth, and then its overall impact on the music industry.
Well, I think there's a lot of things about Sound Exchange that are quite interesting in terms of our growth to this point, our growth as we look down the road. And one of the more critical pieces of Sound Exchange, which is that we are a jointly controlled organization, 50% recording artists, 50% record companies. On the record company side, you have 6 major label representatives on my board, 3 independent label representatives. So, you know, 9 representatives of copyright owners, and you have 9 representatives of recording artists. That 18-member board, you know, it's a very interesting place. You have a lot of historical tension between artists and labels, and sometimes that plays out. But in general, we have a pretty united philosophy in trying to get fair value for what we create when people use it. And so the board has a united purpose and a united mission. You know, sometimes there's different approaches to how we should get there, which leads to some interesting conversations. But I think we represent an interesting opportunity where artists and labels are partners and working together. And I think that that's the only way artists and labels survive 5 years, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, as, you know, the assaults on creators and those who, you know, who own and invest in intellectual property are being assaulted by those who want to use it and pay as little as possible. So it's really up to us to protect our constituents. The Sound Exchange is its constituents. We are labels. We are artists. We don't exist except to help service their interests, to collectively manage their rights, to collectively support the kinds of things they want.
Let me ask you this, John. You say you've got roughly 31,000 acts that you are providing this service for. What percentage of the population that your total potential, shall we call it, customer base, does that represent?
In the United States, we're still working through the list, of people who are owed royalties, and it's a continually changing list. But obviously, we make progress every day, every week. I think, through August of this year, I think we'd already had 5,000 new accounts for 2008 over 2007, and it just keeps growing. 72% of U.S. artists right now. There's another 10% that we have actually contacted, but who haven't. They may be in different stages of returning their paperwork, which gets us up to about 82%.
On a personal level, tell us a little bit more about your interests in the music industry. One of the questions I like to ask industry executives is the classic Beatles versus Stones. Where are you on that one?
Well, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I started playing in a band a week later. The Beatles are why I'm in the music business.
So what do you like to listen to these days?
I'm pretty eclectic. I listen to world music. I listen to classical music. I listen to indie rock. I listen to some classic rock still, Waterloo Sunset, The Kinks. I'll be listening to Arcade Fire or Stars, which was an offshoot of Broken Social Scene, or I might be listening to any number. I love Polyphonic Spree. I'm a huge fan of that band. As a kid, I was always in used record shops, thumbing through the used vinyl, trying to find, something.
Well, John, you've got an amazingly deep and broad background in the music industry, and I can tell why you are so effective in your role as the head of Sound Exchange. I hope that the organization continues to thrive and, as I said at the top of this show, increase its relevance, because everybody in the music industry wants the music industry to survive and remain vital, particularly for those people who make their living making the music that we all consume. So thank you so much for your time and the work that you do. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, and we will keep you informed of our progress, and we want you to do the same for us out here in the Music Industry Forum.
Well, we'll keep fighting, and, we're always looking out to try to protect rights and collect and distribute money as efficiently as we can. Obviously, the more money we can get out for every dollar we collect, obviously that's the goal here.
Thanks for joining us on the Music Industry Forum podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback or suggestions for future guests. You can always reach us via our website, which is at www.musicindustryforum.com. Thanks.